Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'd like to welcome you to Rady Children's Hospital San Diego and the UCSD Department of Pediatrics Grand Rounds and the 13th Annual Lenore Memorial Lecture. So, in keeping with the theme of the Lenore Lecture, I will definitely talk about allergic and immunologic diseases. And I'll be talking mostly about very rare diseases. And also I'll talk a little bit about health disparities, not as much from a socioeconomic basis, but from a rarity in that these diseases are rare. And there's definitely health disparities there. So I do need to do my job and talk about disclosures. I am a consultant for Regeneron, Novartis, and BioVitrum. And that actually does tie in because a lot of the success that we've been able to make actually has been by partnering with the pharmaceutical industry. I also have research support from several different companies. So the story begins with a patient that I saw during my fellowship, a 3-year-old girl who had a rash after cold exposure. Now this patient wasn't just your typical rash. We do see patients with a condition known as cold urticaria, in which you get a rash after touching something cold. That condition can be very severe, and some patients actually can anaphylax if they're swimming in cold water. But this patient had a very different story. Instead, what this patient, or her mother described, was painful, tender, and also occasionally itchy generalized rash that happened after cold exposure, but not direct cold exposure, actually just going out on a cold day or going into an air-conditioned room. The patient also had frequent low-grade fevers, irritability, fatigue, poor appetite when she was feeling bad, and also was really thirsty during these attacks. Occasionally, the child will also have some foot swelling and also would have bilateral conjunctivitis in some of the most severe attacks. And these attacks would happen pretty much on a daily basis, but would be more severe on the days where the child was exposed to more cold. So this child actually was limited significantly in what she was allowed to do and tried to keep her inside most of the time and always sort of bundled up, both to keep her warm and also so that you wouldn't see the rash. The interesting thing about this rash is it was also present at birth. So this child had lived her whole life with the rash. And also, the 32-year-old mother had the exact same history of rash since birth. Now, there was a lot of issues with this, and that first of all, the mother felt actually very guilty about giving this child the same condition that she had. And she actually wasn't the first in her family who had it either. There was also a lot of frustration and despair on the part of the mother because she'd been to many doctors and really wasn't able to get a good answer. There's also a fair amount of embarrassment. She'd be afraid to take the child out because the kid would look like he has measles or something like that, and so she'd always keep the kid bundled up. And this definitely had a significant effect on their quality of life. And the other real problem is physicians, and you can't blame them necessarily because they just don't know. Really, there was not much of a response. Most of the medical providers would say, well, we think you may have cold urticaria, but that really wouldn't help. And also, the physicians just couldn't do much for them. So in a lot of ways, what this family would do is just ignore the medical system and stay away from doctors. So what I'll do today is tell you a little bit about rare diseases, orphan diseases. I'll tell you a little bit about a new classification of syndromes called the autoinflammatory diseases, and then I'll tell you about, in one particular disease, in this patient that I just presented to you, how we use genetics to find the mechanisms and the pathophysiology of this disease. Then I'll tell you a little bit about how we use that information to help patients and actually go towards finding treatments and actually the drug approval process. And then finally, I'll end up with some additional rare diseases that I'm studying. So rare diseases are defined as conditions in which there are less than 200,000 in the United States or around less than 1 in 1,500. Now, that doesn't necessarily sound very rare, but that's the definition that's gone. And so therefore, there are over 7,000 rare diseases. Most of these are in pediatric because many of them are inherited. And that means there's over 30 million patients nationwide with rare disorders if you sort of put them all together. So in other words, 1 in 10 people have a rare disease. even though there's been an effort, there's now only 200 of those diseases actually have FDA-approved medications. The other problem with these diseases is many of them don't have a medical home. Sometimes these diseases sort of defy classification based on our sort of basic specialties that we've sort of created. And so many times they're multi-systemic, and so have there's never sort of one doctor that's sort of willing to sort of take it. And also, there's also, for most of these diseases, there's no active research going on and no funding. And in many situations, what the reality is that in order to get research and funding going, patients and families actually have to do it themselves and create their own foundations and actually oftentimes, many times, support research for these diseases for their children. And the good news is there is several different organizations around the world for rare diseases. There's the National Organization of Rare Diseases, which is here in the United States, but there's also similar organizations that do pretty much the same thing in Europe, Canada, Asia, and other places. Another really good thing, is that the internet has really changed the way we practice medicine and also the way patients sort of can find out stuff about their disease. I think in the past, when all you had was a few textbooks you may be able to find a little blurb about some particular disease, but now if you enter in several different symptoms into a Google search, oftentimes you will get probably more than you want to know, but a lot of information. In my situation, most of the time, patients themselves are actually making the diagnosis, and they're actually contacting me because my name is out there. And many times, the patients are right. They actually make the right diagnosis. Sometimes they don't, but that's to be expected. The other good news is there is NIH funding. There's actually an Office of Rare Diseases, and I've been fortunate to be able to have NIH funding over the last 15 years to study this rare disease and now others. And there's also the Orphan Disease Drug Act, and that was established in 1983, and the Disease Drug Act was created in order to encourage pharmaceutical companies to develop drugs for rare diseases in which there's a small market and not a lot of opportunity for them to make money. And this Disease Drug Act actually has several components. One thing is there's often many requirements that the FDA has for drugs to get approved on a regular basis, and that you need to have at least 1,000 patients and significant experience in multiple different studies and multiple different formats. But with these rare diseases, of course, that's impossible. So there's a lot less requirements for companies to get a drug approved. And so many times when the average drug approval process takes sometimes 10 or 15 years and billions of dollars, these companies can actually get it approved, sometimes, in our case, less than 18 months. There's also tax incentives that are given. There's also enhanced patent protection so that the company can continue to make that medication and make money, which is in a lot of ways their goal. And there's also some marketing incentives as well in terms of letting them do some pricing, which we'll talk about a little bit later. So now there's over 100 drugs that have been given, over 1,000 drugs that have been given orphan drug designation, and 350 of those have actually been approved for the FDA for about 200 of these rare diseases. Now, if that means that many of the diseases have no drugs, the ones that do usually have one or two. And when you compare that to diseases like hypertension and diabetes, where there's hundreds of drugs for each of these things, it's still a health disparity. So why study rare diseases? Well, first of all, and I hope I can convince this to you by the end of the talk, learning about rare diseases teaches us about the function of our normal bodily functions and also applies to more common disease mechanisms. Also, in some ways, because these diseases are the way they are, you can actually have a significant impact, sometimes more than what you get with more complex diseases. For the researcher, there's this idea that this is really a less complex system in many situations. Many of these diseases are genetic or Mendelian, so that they have a single gene. And that, in some ways, allows you to be able to narrow down on the pathophysiology. Also, pretty much from my experience, just the appreciative families, just knowing that you're interested in their disease and what's going on with them makes a world of difference and actually feels good for the researcher. There's also designated funding sources, as I mentioned. And in my case, there was less competition. So I could actually pick a disease, study it, and then actually call myself the world's expert. So my interest in rare diseases began in medical school. I really was impressed by Ken Jones's recognizable patterns of human malformation, and I actually enjoyed just looking at it. So actually, during medical school, I came out to San Diego. This was one of my first experiences with San Diego, to work with Ken, and actually did an elective in dysmorphology. During that time, I also started surfing. In fellowship, I ran into a patient who had some very unusual features. This was a six-year-old who had some dysmorphic features and also had recurrent infection, had several limb anomalies, and also had hypogammaglobulinemia with immunoglobulins that were low. And so this child, we looked in the literature and went through all the databases and couldn't find any other patient that sort of fit this criteria, so we published it. In 2001. Since that time, actually, there have been several case reports that fit the same exact phenotypic description. Now, one thing we did, we weren't very creative with the name when we published this disease, and that was good and bad. One is it doesn't get a lot of sort of quick recognition like many of the names with acronyms. But the other thing that happened that was a little bit unusual is instead of giving it a particular name, this disease is now known as Hoffman syndrome. So it's still possible to get a disease named after you if you're uncreative with your titles, with your disease names. Back to the three-year-old girl who has the rash after cold exposure. This is a child I saw in fellowship who we talked about before. So when I saw this this patient and talked to the family, I went straight to the library. That's what you had to do back then. Now you don't even go to the library, you just go online. But this disease certainly wasn't going to be Hoffman syndrome 2 because it had been described in 1940 by a couple dermatologists in St. Louis. This disease, as you can tell from the presentation, presents very early in life and actually persists throughout life. And as I mentioned, the rash develops with cold, generalized cold exposure, but it doesn't happen right away. It usually takes a couple hours after the cold exposure. And there's also no rash with direct cold contact. And one thing that we do as allergists to test for this condition, cold urticaria, is we take an ice cube and put it on the skin for a couple minutes. And in classic cold urticaria, what will happen is you'll get a classic itchy, sort of swollen hive that'll last for anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes. So these patients actually have a negative ice cube test. And there are also several associated systemic inflammatory symptoms. They also have fever, they get joint pain, and conjunctivitis. And the skin rash, even though it's been called cold urticaria, is really not a classic urticaria. And unlike urticaria, which responds very well to antihistamines, these patients really get very little improvement with antihistamines. And if they take them, they're usually just to help them go to sleep at night. So the typical story that you hear from patients is they often wake up in the morning feeling pretty good. By the afternoon, depending on their cold exposure, they are starting to feel a little bit of pain and rash. And by the evening, they're having fever, chills, really like they have the flu. And then they'll often get the conjunctivitis and severe joint pains. And that goes into the evening. And then they finally are able to get to go to sleep. And then by the next morning, they feel okay again. So it's sort of this daily thing that goes on. And the severity of the symptoms depends, to some extent, on how much exposure to cold they had during the day. So when you look at the rash pathologically, what you see is some dermal edema. That's the white areas in the dermis. I guess I could use this right in here. But the really unusual feature of these patients is the neutrophilic, really predominant neutrophilic infiltrate that we see in the dermis, that's oftentimes around the vessels, but not in the vessels themselves, so it's not a vasculitis. And if you look at just simple blood tests on these patients, they often have elevated white counts during these attacks. And on a regular basis or chronic basis, they have elevated SED rates and CRPs, really indicating that there is systemic inflammation going on. They don't have autoantibodies for the most part. So in general, from an immunologic standpoint, we usually classify diseases as either immune deficiency, which means you don't have enough immune system, or you have too much immune system, which would be allergic diseases in the case of mast cell-mediated, IgE-mediated diseases, or autoimmune diseases in which you have autoantibodies against your own tissue. But there are a number of different immune diseases that over the last years, since this classification has been created, 50, 60, even 100 years ago, and there are many of these diseases that we see and many different specialists see but don't fit nicely into this sort of standard classification system. Conditions like gout or Crohn's disease, sarcoidosis, Behçet's, Still's disease, both juvenile onset and adult onset. Conditions like hereditary angioedema, and also the recurrent fever disorders. And it was really the recurrent fever disorders that have that really made us think about sort of a new way to classify some immune diseases. And these conditions are now known as the autoinflammatory diseases. These are disorders with recurrent episodes of inflammation, but really with no other evidence of the other types of immune disease. So there's no evidence of infection, even though many of these patients have fever. And many of these patients may look like allergic disease, but there's no evidence of IgE-mediated disease. In addition, many of the patients have symptoms consistent with your sort of classic autoimmune or rheumatologic diseases, but you don't see any autoantibodies or antigen-specific T cells. And instead of lymphocytes being sort of the big mediators here, what it appears to be in these diseases is a predominance of monocytes and neutrophils, so really an involvement of the innate immune system. And so what these diseases are felt to be is really disturbances of homeostasis of cytokine responses or aberrant bacterial sensing, where they're actually maybe over-responding to bacteria that we normally are able to ignore. So the hereditary fever disorders include familial Mediterranean fever, hyper-IgD syndrome, the tumor necrosis factor receptor-associated syndrome, as well as a condition called Muckle-Wells syndrome. And when I noticed familial cold urticaria, it seemed like that disease fit better into the fever disorders than it did into urticarial disorders. So I came up with the name familial cold autoinflammatory syndrome. At the time that I first started seeing these patients, there was a lot going on in genetics. And actually, between the years of 1997 and 1999, the genes for each of these hereditary fever disorders was being identified one by one. And so my idea was to try to find the gene for FCAS. And so I spent the next couple of years traveling around the country, meeting patients with FCAS. Many of these meetings were actually family reunions, where we would set up a time. I would come, they would gather as many of their family together in their living room. We would talk about the research. They would sign consents. And we would line them up, draw their blood so we can make DNA, and then we would have lunch. If you look at the map here, which is a little bit outdated, but one thing you'll notice, the large circles are more than 10 patients in a particular area. The medium-sized circles are between 3 and 9, and the small circles are 1 or 2 patients. But if you map these families also on average annual temperature, what you'll notice is that the most of the majority of patients live in this sort of nice temperate zone here. You'll notice there are some patients that live in the slightly cooler area, but you see very few patients living in the coldest part of the country. The other thing you notice is there are very few patients living in the hottest parts of the country. And the reason for that is air conditioning. These patients really cannot tolerate air conditioning on a regular basis. So I spent a lot of time in the southeast in Texas, and also we have patients here in Southern California. So really what's happened with these patients is they've chosen, based on their disease, to live in particular areas. So these are the initial six pedigrees that we identified. This is a classic autosomal dominant inheritance pattern. What you see is there's no skipping of generations. You see both males and females affected. And if you look, pretty much overall, when you have the disease, about half of your kids end up with the disease. So this is a, for the most part, completely penetrant disease. Now, the three family trees here are all pretty classic for autosomal dominant inheritance. But these three families actually were a little bit curious to us, because what happened is they were new onset disease, where both parents didn't have the disease, but the child would then have it, and even though multiple other siblings may not, and then that child will then pass it on to theirs. And initially we thought this was a little bit unusual, but this is how autosomal dominant diseases start. You get a sporadic mutation that's just a matter of luck or failure of to correct that mutation, and then you then pass it on. So we took a whole genome approach to this disease. And this involves using genotyping and all over the entire genome through all 22 chromosomes. And this process can sometimes take years back when we were doing this. Now it actually just takes a few weeks, sometimes a few days. But this, for us, we actually started on chromosome 1 because chromosome 1 was the first first chromosome. It's actually the largest and probably one of the most difficult chromosomes to work with. But it turns out we never had to go to the other chromosomes because we found linkage on chromosome 1. So luck is definitely playing a part here. So we were able to identify the one particular part on chromosome 1 where the disease gene was found. This is at the tip of chromosome 1 called 1Q44. And then by identifying additional families, genotyping them, and using additional genotyping markers, we were able to limit the disease gene to a pretty small region of about 1 megabase. Now, 1 megabase means 1 million base pairs, so that's still a lot of A, T, Gs, and Cs. But it's a region that you can actually start looking at gene by gene and actually try to figure out what's going on. Now, at that time, there were no known genes in the region. There were a lot of potential genes. And so what we started to do, really just brute force, was sequencing anything that looked like a gene in that region in our patients from different families. And after a couple of years of doing this and sequencing over 80 different potential genes, we found mutations in our patients with FCAS. We also actually had collected a patient with Muckle-Wells syndrome, which is a similar presentation but has some other features, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. So it turned out that we identified this gene that we called the CIAS1 gene for cold-induced autoinflammatory syndrome 1. I can recommend not putting coming up with a name that is CIA in it because you'll get all kinds of Googles. Instead, this gene has been renamed NLRP3. As you can see, most of the mutations are located in the central part of the gene. And the protein we call cryopyrin, which literally means icy fire or for the cold-induced fevers that we see. And this protein actually had some similarities to a protein known as pyrin, which is the protein that is responsible for familial Mediterranean fever, one of those hereditary fever disorders. So there were four of our initial large families. We've actually now identified over 25 large families. But four of these families, actually, three out of these four large families actually had a very unique story. So when I would go to these family reunions, I would talk to them and tell them why I was doing this and that my goal was to try to figure out what caused their disease. And many of the patients, many times the great-grandparents or grandparents, would say, well, we know exactly how this disease started. This one family said that their great-great-great-great-grandfather was a farmer who worked on a hot summer day but fell into a cold pool of water. And after falling into this water, he was severely sick, almost died, but then after that would always have the symptoms that these patients, and then he passed it on to multiple generations. And I would tell them that's a really nice story, but that's not how genetics works. You don't get cold-induced mutations. So the other family I went to, the first family was here in California. The second family I went to was in the Midwest, and they mentioned that their great-great-great-grandfather was a sawmill worker who fell into a cold river and developed symptoms afterwards, passed it on. Again, I said that's a nice story. The third family I went to was the family in the Southeast, and they had actually traced their disease back all the way to a gentleman who came over from Europe in the 1600s on a ship and actually was in a shipwreck. And during that shipwreck, he was exposed to cold water, almost died, but survived. So it turned out when we actually did the genetics on all these families that those all four of these families actually had the exact same mutation. And when we actually did the genetics, all four of these families actually had the same founder. So this is these families are actually all related. But one of those families actually that didn't have the story has the same mutation but is not related. So we really showed that what goes on in the United States is actually a large founder effect, and that most of the patients, probably 80% of the patients with this disease, are all related to one central guy. So we initially found a few mutations. Other people with other patients with FCAS and also the Muckle-Wells syndrome found more mutations. And then it turned out that another disease that had some similarities to both of these diseases, except much more severe and much more chronic, with a lot more CNS problems, a condition called neonatal onset multisystem inflammatory disease, or chronic infantile neurologic cutaneous articular syndrome, also had mutations in this exact gene. So now, starting from just this one rare little disease, we've now identified over 82 mutations, and really in three different diseases, or really one disease with three different phenotypes. And so these diseases are now known as either cryopyrinopathies or CAPS, which is cryopyrin-associated periodic syndromes. in which case FCAS, which is where I've had my most experience, is the mildest. Muckle-Wells syndrome, which has similar rash, but not often cold-induced, and also with some hearing problems as well as kidney problems. And then NOMID, which is the most severe, which has those same things that we see in Muckle-Wells syndrome, but also has significant CNS inflammation. So when you find a gene, actually a lot of different people get involved. So within a few months of actually identifying the gene, several different groups began working on its function. And that turned out to be really good for us because people working all around the world actually helped us figure out what this gene does. So it turns out that cryopyrin is an intracellular protein, and it's an intracellular immune regulatory protein. And what it does is it binds to a few adaptor proteins, one known as ASC and another known as cardinal, and it also binds to a few chaperone proteins like HSP90 and SGT1. And this is a complex of proteins in the cell that also attach to caspase-1. And the role of caspase-1 is to cleave a very important inflammatory mediator known as IL-1-beta. So what happens is when this complex comes together, the complex is known as the inflammasome, it is activated through this ATP and potassium-mediated process. And once caspase-1 is activated, it cleaves pro-IL-1-beta, which then allows the active form of IL-1-beta to leave the cell. And once IL-1-beta leaves the cell, it can then bind to receptors on other cells, which then results in an inflammatory cascade, or even on receptors on itself, so it really causes this autocrine inflammatory process. This then will lead to a downstream cytokine, such as IL-6 and other things, and then results in the inflammation that we see. So it turns out at the same time that we're studying this particular complex in this protein, a lot of other people were looking at what activates this complex. And it turns out there are a number of different activators, including urate or CPBD crystals, which are noticed in gout, silica and asbestos, which cause silicosis and asbestosis, cholesterol, which will result in atherosclerosis, and also islet amyloid, which is one of the pathophysiologies of diabetes. So it turns out from this one little rare disease, which led to this one little rare disease gene, it turns out there are now multiple diseases that are felt to be due to this complex of the inflammasome, including gout, pseudogout, asbestosis, silicosis, atherosclerosis, and diabetes. So this one little rare thing turned out to be very important for lots of different diseases. Now, our interest has still been in how this disease works and why these patients get the symptoms. So our concept is, our hypothesis is, that a mutation in cryopyrin is a gain-of-function mutation that then, when activated by the cold, results in increased activation of the inflammasome, increased caspase-1, and increased IL-1-beta. And then IL-1-beta leads to all the inflammatory symptoms that we see in our patients. Now, if you model all the mutations, what you see is they're actually all in one particular region of this complex. And what happens is these proteins actually form hexamers with multiple different proteins combined. And it looks like if you map all these different mutations, you'll see that they all sort of line this inner sort of surface here, suggesting that these mutations somehow affect the protein-protein interactions. So the concept is that if you have a normal cryopyrin, sometimes it'll become active, but also become inactive. But if you have a mutant cryopyrin, it's much more driven towards an active cryopyrin, which then forces the complex and increases your IL-1-beta inflammation. So what does this mean for the patients? Because really our goal in this in the beginning was to try to help the patients. And so fortunately we were able to use some of this information to help our patients. Now one thing we can do is we can actually study our patients. The nice thing about this disease is you can induce the disease just by putting patients in a cold room. This is my preferred method of cold challenge. The cold challenge is really easy. All we do is we use cold rooms like you see in labs or something like you might see at a restaurant and put the patient in there for about 30 minutes. And during that time, we just would tell jokes and talk. And then after that, we would admit the patient to the hospital and watch them over the next 24 hours. And this is a very reproducible thing. The patients will start with a little bit of a rash a few hours after the cold challenge. Within a few more hours, they start to feel a little sick with a little bit of fever and muscle pains. And then by 8 hours, their symptoms are peaking, where they have really florid rash, significant fever, joint pain, oftentimes conjunctivitis. And then they go to sleep, and by the next morning, they're better again. And this is a very sort of reproducible thing. We can do this in many times. You can also, during this procedure, collect blood at different time points and also skin to learn more about the disease. And so here's a graph of the oral temperature, and you can see it's a low-grade temperature, but definitely the patients versus the controls get a little bit febrile and peak at about 8 hours when all their symptoms are peaking. If you look at the white counts, they're slightly elevated at baseline, but within a few hours they start to increase and again peak at about 8 hours when all their symptoms are peaking. And so based on our model, we would think that IL-1 beta would be elevated in their blood. But unfortunately, when we looked for IL-1 beta, we didn't find anything in the blood. What we did find actually was serum IL-6, which is usually a good marker of IL-1 beta. It's often very difficult to find IL-1 beta in the blood because very small amounts are able to create significant symptoms, and often it binds to a lot of different proteins. So our question was, where is it coming from? And so one thing we looked at was the blood cells that we actually took from the blood. And we looked using very sensitive techniques to actually measure RNA to see if we could find the IL-1 and IL-6. And interestingly, we didn't find any elevated IL-1 and IL-6 in the cells that are circulating in the blood. So our question is, where are these cytokines coming from? Now, I told you we also collected skin, and we were able to use the same sensitive technique and found significantly elevated levels of both IL-1 beta and IL-6 in the skin, suggesting that this is really the skin is where it's happening. We were able to confirm that with immunohistochemistry. So when we looked in the blood, we did see elevated IL-6, and as I said, IL-6 is a good indicator of IL-1. And the IL-6 starts a little bit elevated, increases really quickly, and peaks at 4 hours, and it's peaking prior to the peak in all the symptoms, which usually happens at 8 hours. By that time, the IL-6 is already going down, and then by the end, it's completely back to normal. And this is a very reproducible thing. So knowing more about the involvement of IL-1 beta gives us some opportunities to try to target this pathway. And so there are a number of different possibilities. You could go upstream and try to target the ATP potassium, which is important in triggering the inflammasome. You could try to target the inflammasome directly. You could try to target caspase 1. And there are actually drugs that target HSP90, such as galdanomycin. And there's also specific caspase 1 inhibitors. You could also go downstream and try to hit IL-1 beta, and that's been the focus of a lot of pharmaceutical companies. Or you could try to block the receptor in which IL-1 binds to. Both of these would then result in preventing the downstream inflammation. You could even go farther downstream and try to block the signaling of the receptor, or try to block the cytokines that are part of that inflammatory cascade. Fortunately for us, there was already a drug that was approved that hits this pathway, and this drug is known as anakinra or Kineret. And it was approved for rheumatoid arthritis in 2001, but really no one was using it because it doesn't work as well as some of the other drugs approved. But for us, it was perfect. We were able to use this medication to test a proof of concept in our patients. And so the protocol really was very much similar. We just, instead of just putting them in the cold room, we gave them a couple shots of anakinra prior to the challenge. And the results were remarkable. The patients had absolutely no rash after the cold challenge and actually had no rash for the next 2 to 3 days. In addition, that increased temperature was completely blocked. The increased white count was significantly blunted. And we completely stopped the increase in IL-6, really showing that this disease, the IL-6, is due to IL-1, and IL-1 is what's really causing the disease. So anakinra, since that time, doesn't just work in this cold challenge, but it's been used in multiple trials around the world in the three different phenotypes, FCAS, Muckle Wells, and Noman. And Noman has really been the most amazing thing, because these are children who oftentimes wouldn't live to adulthood and had many, many problems, both CNS as well as musculoskeletal. But there's a few unfavorable features of this drug. One is it has a very short half-life, requiring daily injections, and oftentimes these injections are painful because of an additive in the medication. And it's also not widely available around the world. It is here available in the U.S., but it's sometimes difficult to track down. So there were other companies that were interested in IL-1 beta for a number of different reasons. One had made this drug called rilonacept, which is a designer protein. What it does is they've taken different parts of natural proteins that normally bind to IL-1 beta, actually parts of the receptor and parts of the accessory protein, put it together with an IgG, and created a protein with high affinity for IL-1 beta. And this had the advantage that you could give it, instead of once a day, you could give it actually once a week. And this drug, actually, we participated in some trials. One of the trials, which was through the FDA's Orphan Disease Drug Act, was with 47 patients. I know it doesn't sound like a lot of patients, but to get that many patients into a trial It's such a rare disease, is actually a big deal. This trial actually started with a basic model in which you have a run-in period, and then you have patients that either get drug or placebo. And then it had a second part where everyone went on drug in part B, and then those patients would then be withdrawn, either would stay on drug or be withdrawn to placebo. And then there was an open-label extension. And the results, just like we saw in Anakinra, were really remarkable. It's really an on and off situation. The moment you touch these patients with drug, you get remarkable decrease in their symptoms, oftentimes within 12 to 24 hours. And that then persists throughout. So what you see here is the patients who were on drug dropped significantly in their symptom score. The patients who were on placebo continued to have their symptoms, but then when they went into the open label, single blind, they had a significant drop in their symptoms just the same, and this would persist. And then when you did the withdrawal, what you see is as you take patients off drug, they start to get their symptoms right back. So it really is an on-off situation. And really unusual in any clinical research to see this type of a response. So we ended up with 47 patients actually being overpowered for the effectiveness. And there's also been another drug that's been put together, which is a monoclonal antibody to IL-1 beta, and this has direct binding, and the advantage of this drug is it can actually be given every 2 months. And this drug also underwent a similar type of a FDA orphan drug approval process and was approved just last in 2009. And so there's now really hundreds of patients around the world both on these particular drugs. So as you can see, Anakinra binds to the receptor. These two drugs bind directly to the IL-1 beta. So this is really a translational success story. We started with patients and families. We then characterized the disease, identified the gene, helped figure out what that gene does, how that affects inflammatory pathways, and then used drugs that target that pathway to treat the exact same families that we started with in the beginning. But it's not just been with these rare diseases. There's now been several trials with a lot of these other inflammasome-mediated diseases to show that IL-1 therapy can affect patients really with severe gout that don't respond to other medications, but also pseudo-gout. There's also trials in type 2 diabetes with very interesting results. And also it's now being used in patients who've just had a heart attack and to try to block the remodeling that goes on. It's also being used in several rheumatologic conditions, such as juvenile Still's disease, both adult and juvenile, and also Schnitzler's disease as well. So again, this one little disease has spread out to lots of different diseases and taught us a lot. Now, it's not all good news. There are some safety issues. As with any effective drugs, there are issues. One thing is IL-1 is there for a reason, and its primary reason is probably to fight infection. And definitely there's evidence to suggest that if you don't have IL-1, you are more susceptible, particularly to gram-positive pathogens like strep. There's different mouse models, and there's also an immune deficiency called IRAK4 deficiency, where you don't signal through your IL-1 receptor. In those patients, their biggest problem is getting strep infections. Now, with a lot of these immune modulator drugs, you usually sort of expect to get kind of weird infections, but you don't get that with these drugs. Instead, what you get is just increased routine infections, oftentimes strep infections, sinusitis, and things like that. So many of these patients, before they started drug, would tell me that they were actually the healthiest person in their family in terms of getting colds and all kinds of routine infections. But once they went on drug, now they're getting all the different infections that they started, that their other siblings would get. There's also some cardiovascular complications. Many of the patients gain weight. There's also been evidence of increased cholesterol and some cases of congestive heart failure. So the story's not all good. There's also significant economic issues. These drugs are extremely expensive. Anakinra, which is in line with a lot of other biologics, is $15,000 a year. It actually hasn't even been approved yet for CAPS, but there's plans to do that. But both rilonacept and canakinumab, which went through the Orphan Disease Drug Act, are charging really incredible amounts of money. Fortunately, insurance usually covers it. There are sometimes issues with lifetime coverage and things like that. But for the most part, we've been able to get most patients on therapy because for the insurance companies, this is one person in their entire panel of people. And so one person doesn't really have a major effect for them. But clearly, this is something that causes significant problems for the patients and actually makes them worry a lot. So in summary, CAPS is a continuum of rare autoinflammatory diseases, and it's caused by mutations in this gene. IL-1 targeted therapy definitely works in these patients and has really been a translational success story. And as I mentioned from the beginning, studying rare diseases is challenging but also has several advantages. So before I end, I just want to tell you about one other patient who I saw more recently, and this is a 3-year-old patient with a cold-induced rash, but a very different story. This child actually has a daily rash, like we see in FCAS, that sometimes can be painful, but it happens immediately, not delayed, and it happens with direct contact as well as with exposure. These patients don't get the systemic inflammatory symptoms, but they sometimes will have hypotension and anaphylaxis if they're actually swimming, more similar to what we see in the classic cold urticaria. But the unusual thing about this, one thing you can see from this particular child is just by crying, he gets a hive as a tear goes down his face. If you look at the skin biopsy, this is much more classic urticaria. These patients have mast cell activation, and they do better on antihistamines. So this condition we called familial atypical cold urticaria. I'll let you do the acronym. So that's probably not going to stick either. This condition is also autosomal dominant inheritance. These patients, like FCAS, have a negative ice cube test. And interestingly, cold water, though, can trigger the rash. And so you can actually put water on them with the tears that you saw and actually get the rash. And as I mentioned, these patients can have systemic inflammatory symptoms. So we figured we did it with one, we can do it with another. And I've identified one initial family, but now we've identified a total of 5 families with this disease. And working together in collaboration with the NIH, we've been doing genetic mapping. And I can tell you it's much faster and much easier than it used to be. This time, we now have linkage on chromosome 16, and just last month we've identified the gene. I'll tell you more about it in the next time I talk to you. So this work could not be done without the patients. And as I mentioned, this research is really pushed forward by the patients. Also, the referring clinicians who see these patients are a really big part of it. I've had a number of different wonderful people working in my lab, including technicians, PhD students, MD students, and I've had a lot of wonderful mentors and support from UCSD and from the NIH. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You mentioned amyloid disease and amyloid deposition in your talk, and I wondered if you, now that your patients have survived so long, whether some of your older patients are showing an increase in Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, we haven't seen that, actually, at all. And the weird thing about this disease is you'd expect these patients with chronic inflammation to have all the diseases that are now being associated with chronic inflammation, you know, heart disease, diabetes, all the different things like that. And for some reason, these patients, either because of other background genetics or maybe it's good in some ways to have a little bit of this IL-1, don't seem to have, you know, any higher rate, and to my feeling, have potentially lower rates of some of these other chronic inflammatory diseases.
So, Hal, you are not on the schedule, but this is the best Lenoir that we have had. Thank you very much. So, and to go really from the disease to the gene to the treatment, usually in a lifetime, is amazing, and you have done it in 10 years or so. So it's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So the question that I have really is, it's not clear to me, is what are the first few steps that occur that activate the inflammasome? And you had at one stage potassium channels on the right side.
Right.
And you didn't speak about this and ATP and so on and so forth. So how does it start? How does it really actually start?
The simple answer is we still don't know. And that's good, because there's a lot we can still learn. There's a lot of questions about what triggers the inflammasome from a normal standpoint. Because there's so many different triggers. I mean, I mentioned, you know, uric acid and as well as these different crystals like silica, as well as amyloid and things like that. But there is really no great unifying theory to explain how all of these different things could activate this process. There have been some theories put forward. One of the theories is that all of these things interfere with the membrane as the macrophage tries to engulf these different things, but is unable to, and it's a process called frustrated phagocytosis. There are issues with that because there are also triggers that don't involve sort of difficulties in phagocytosis. There's been a big push, with a lot of controversy over the last couple of years, suggesting that all of these things cause reactive oxygen species. But there's also some significant data showing that you do not need a lot of reactive oxygen. So actually patients with CGD who can't mount the response don't actually can mount an inflammasome response. So there's clearly other ways. Even if ROS may be involved, there may be other things as well. The whole idea with the potassium channels and ATP, I think, is one possible mechanism, but it doesn't explain everything. And none of this actually, to me, explains how in the mutated gene with our patients, cold can trigger these symptoms. And that's actually one of our biggest questions, is how cold is triggering. I've got lots of ideas, but no answers for you yet.
Have you learned to replace the gene yet?
The simple answer is no, not yet. This is a little bit more difficult because it's a mutant gene. So in many of these genetic diseases, they're missing a gene or missing, you know, gene function. In this particular situation, we're fairly sure this is a gain of function. So you'd have to sort of eliminate the mutant gene not just replace it like you can do. We do have mice now that actually have the same mutations. I didn't have time to tell you about those. And so we are able to do the kind of things, you know, potentially in the future, to test them in the mice that we can then potentially apply to patients later.
Hal, very nice presentation. In the biopsy, you showed us that the inflammatory infiltrate was primarily neutrophilic. And so I didn't think it was surprising that the complication of this drug are bacterial infections. With that in mind, you measured the IL, whatever number it was, levels. After in that protocol, did you also do histology on the skin to see if there was a reduction in neutrophils?
Yes. Yeah. They had actually. We did look at post-treatment skin, and there was no effect at all. I mean, really. So if you don't get rash, which these patients didn't get, you don't get neutrophils. It's really very consistent. When you see the rash, you see neutrophils. It's really one of the class. Now, the interesting thing about this from a pathologic standpoint, and I appreciate any impact, anything you would say, is one thing: when you usually see neutrophilic inflammation, you usually see tissue damage, because that's neutrophils' jobs. Is they go in, and then they, you know, release their granules. They're kind of just, you know, the sort of forces that kind of go out there and release granules. What we see is these patients on a regular basis have neutrophils go into the tissue, but we don't see chronic damage. So the neutrophils are actually on their own being programmed to die and not do their thing, or being engulfed or something. So there's a mechanism there that's on a daily basis that's actually preventing neutrophilic tissue damage.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.